You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. On this month's show, we talk to poet Amy Key about her new book, Arrangements in Blue, and her appearance as part of Brighton Festival's Books and Debate programme on April the 20th, to local writer Kate Bradley about her new novel, The Sisterhood, which is a feminist retelling of Orwell's 1984, to Kathy Hayward and Mark Slater about the creative writing programme and author of this month's book club book, Brighton-based author Jane Crittenden. The Book Club is also available as a podcast, and you can download that from whenever you get yours. Enjoy the show. When poet Amy Key was growing up, she looked forward to a life shaped by romance, fueled by desire, longing, and the conventional markers of success that come when you share a life with another person. But that didn't happen for her. Now, in her 40s, she sets out to explore the realities of a life lived in the absence of romantic love. Using Joni Mitchell's seminal album Blue, which shaped Key's expectation of love, as an anchor, Arrangements in Blue elegantly honours a life lived completely by and for oneself. Building a home, travelling alone, choosing whether to be a mother, recognising her own milestones, learning the limits of self-care and the expansive potential of self-friendship, Key uncovers the many forms of connection and care that go unnoticed. With profound candour and intimacy, Arrangements in Blue explores the painful feelings we are usually too ashamed to discuss: loneliness, envy, grief, and failure. The result is a book which inspires us to live and love more honestly. Welcome to the Brighton Book Club, Amy Key.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And congratulations on the publication of Arrangements in Blue. This is a truly stunning book.
I don't know what to say.
So you have previously published two collections of poetry and multiple essays, one of which was A Bleed of Blue, which was published in Granta and inspired this longer form memoir. How has the experience been of turning your hand into kind of from essays to books?
Yeah, I think it's one of endurance. I didn't realise how much stamina it was going to take, because when you write a poetry collection, you're just accumulating poems over several years. And I certainly never felt that kind of pressure to produce in the same way that I did with the book. And because I also work full time, so it was kind of hard to find the right space in which to write, because, you know, by the time I finish my working day, my brain is just like jelly, completely useless. You know, I find it hard even composing text messages, let alone trying to write prose. So I tended to write very early in the morning before I started work, and used holidays and weekends. And sometimes it was quite hard to motivate myself to, you know, not just flop and watch TV or hang out with my friends, but prioritize writing the book and trying to kind of create the right environment for thinking it through, because I can't just write anywhere, anytime. It's not how I operate, sadly.
So I know you're going to read some from the book very shortly, but I'd like to ask you, why Joni Mitchell and why Blue?
Yeah, so perhaps that the extract that I'll read from the book will tell a little bit of a story about this. I think there's something about the point at which I first heard Blue, being a young teenager, is such a kind of potent and powerful, mysterious time, because you're kind of encountering your womanhood for the first time, your kind of burgeoning sexuality, and forming opinions in your own value system. And Blue came to me at that age, and I just feel like it was a perfect, you know, a serendipitous age, if you'd like, to encounter Blue, this short, beautifully intact record that was kind of like a document for me of what I thought adult womanhood would be. Telling the story of, you know, love and adventure and travel and jealousy and heartbreak and failure and renewal. So I think that's probably why I came back to Joni's music, to explore something that has kind of accompanied me, like this idea of romantic love eluding me. So even when I've had romantic relationships or like quasi romantic relationships, I've never managed to quite attain the type of romantic connections that other people have had. I feel like because I trusted in Blue so much, it was a kind of interesting safe space to explore those issues.
Well, can we hear some, please?
Of course, yeah. So I'll read a short section from the beginning, which introduces how I first came to know Joni's music. I think back to 1992 and the first time I heard Blue. My best friend had recently begun to have periods and one had just started. She was sleeping on the pull-out bed that lived under my own. We called it the surfboard. My red and purple love lamp was on, the rest of the lights were off. We listened to the album on cassette, borrowed from my older sister, Rebecca, an emotional inheritance. The first song is All I Want. Into the dark cocoon of our sleepover, Joni sang, I am on a lonely road and I am travelling, 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 looking for something. What can it be? I remember having a strange feeling, an anxiety adjacent excitement, a bodily sense that I too would experience something transformative and soon. I joined Joni on the road she was travelling. I knew I would not sleep until the cassette had clicked onto the B-side and I had heard the last note of the last song. In my memory of that night, the lava lamp was like the pain my friend was experiencing, the red hot pulse of it, pain as a red energy, as hypnotic, pain that moves as an octopus might in the deep seas of womanhood and romantic grief, thresholds I had yet to cross. I was 14 and yearning to swim in both. That night, Blue ignited my desire and ambition for romantic love, my idea of how I would press my heart against the world. What appealed, I think, was the way it described the complexities of love. It was the first representation of love that seemed truthful. Love as best and worst, joy and sorrow. I'd hurt someone, they would hurt me. Love meant staying and going, the bothness of it suddenly clear. And love did not need to mean convention, perhaps not marriage, perhaps not children. The music's harmonic cascades in all their sprawling highs and lows mapped the course I and romantic love would take. Blue seemed to give me a complete palette to paint myself into all life's possibilities. I took in the album's emotional range and it became innate. I accepted Blue as part of the language I had to express myself. In early crushes and relationships, I test my feelings against Blue's sentiments, as though the album provided an ultimate scale of intensity that would reveal whether the love had substance. Was this a love so strong I couldn't numb it out of myself with wine? Did it have the endurance of the Northern Star? Could it keep away my blues? Would it anchor me where I stood or let me sail away? Looking back now, I think I tricked myself into believing almost all of my romantic attachments measured up against Blue's scale. I accepted love would bring me pain, so much so that joyful love became not an expectation, but an occasional gift. Love meant being prepared to bleed. I was ready to commit to it. But while I have certainly bled for romantic love, I've largely found myself living without it. The last time I had a boyfriend, I was 22. I'm about to turn 44. In my early years of knowing Blue, I thought I was at the beginning of romantic love's presence in my life. All beginnings incorporate the potential for an end. I just had no idea how rapidly I'd get there.
Oh, Amy, your prose is so beautiful. I love prose written by poets. There's something so rhythmic and delicious about it. It kind of is completely transformative. So thank you so much. So this is a beautiful meditation on love, but it's also a big meditation about grief. Mm. And I'd love to know how it felt for you putting something so personal and so raw out there.
So I guess there are two kinds of grief operating in the book. There's the kind of grief which is grief for something that I haven't got in my life, i.e. romantic love, but there's also the grief for my friend Roddy Lumsden, who I write a chapter about in the book. And I felt I had to write about Roddy because he was such a transformative figure in my life. And there was something about our relationship that, you know, were I to have a big constellation of exes and great loves, he would be in there, even though we did not have a romantic relationship. But he had a significance that is absolutely fundamental to the telling of this particular story. I wrote the chapter about Roddy first, mainly because I thought, if I can write this, I can probably write the rest of the book. I knew that it would be very hard. And if I could kind of be the sort of vulnerable and I needed to be to write about Roddy's life and his death from alcoholism, and how I responded to that, I felt I could probably give the other bits of the book a go. And it means a lot to me that he's in the book because, well, I guess for two reasons. One is because it helps me explore this idea of different types of loves and relationships that we don't attribute a status to. But also it allows me to make a tribute to Roddy, who was incredibly special to me, but also a brilliantly talented poet who deserves to be more widely read.
How do you feel, Amy, that people who have a life with romantic love not at the centre are treated these days? And do you think there's a kind of a space for them in society?
I guess my experience has been, I felt a lot of shame about not having romantic love because I've tended to, you know, within the heteronormative culture that I have been raised in, I haven't really had any role models who have shown me that life as a single person can be very fulfilling. And I haven't probably explored enough the different types of romantic and sexual identity that there are out there. You know, that there are people who are asexual or aromantic, and there are whole fantastic kind of cultures within different preferences that I haven't possibly spent enough time exploring. But unfortunately, like, I'm a cis het woman who desires, you know, a romantic relationship, and I think in that context, you know, you can end up feeling quite a lot of shame that you've not somehow been chosen, or that there must be something wrong with you because everyone else around you seems to have a romantic partner and you don't. And it always has felt like people have considered me in a temporary state of being until I attain the thing that would make everyone just relax. You know, Amy's paired up now, coupled up, and we can not worry about her anymore.
Gosh, it's so interesting and so thought-provoking. And I'd really urge anyone listening to this to get their hands on a copy of Arrangements in Blue, which is out now. So Amy will be appearing as part of Brighton Festival's Books and Debate programme on the 20th of May at 6 p.m. at Brighton School for Girls. Amy, what can we expect for this event?
Well, very excitingly, I'm going to be in conversation with the poet and broadcaster Vanessa Consula. And if any of you are on Twitter, you might have recently seen Vanessa herself has so many brilliant, challenging thoughts on the issue of being without romantic love. And she wrote this absolutely extraordinary thread recently that went completely crazily viral. And I'd urge you all to look that up. So I think Vanessa, what will be so interesting about that is because Vanessa and I share some of that, you know, some of the same experiences. And I don't think I've ever been in conversation with somebody who is, you know, in air quotes, like me. So that feels really, really exciting. And she's also just like a brilliant speaker. So I think there'll be really, really great conversation in Brighton.
Thank you very much for joining us, Amy. You can find more information and grab tickets over on the Brighton Festival website. In Oceania, whoever you are, Big Brother is always watching you, and trust is a luxury that no one has. Julia is the seemingly perfect example of what women in Oceania should be. Dutiful, useful, subservient, meek. But Julia hides a secret that would lead her to death if it is discovered. For Julia is part of the underground movement called the Sisterhood, whose main goal is to find members of the Brotherhood, the anti-party vigilante group, and help them overthrow Big Brother. Only then can everyone be truly free. When Julia thinks she's found a potential member of the Brotherhood, it seems like their goal might be finally in their grasp. But as she gets closer to Winston Smith, Julia's past starts to catch up with her, and we soon realise that she has many more secrets than we'd first imagined, and that overthrowing Big Brother might cost her everything. But if you have nothing left to lose, then you don't mind playing the game. Welcome back to the Brighton Book Club, Kate Bradley.
Oh, really nice to be here. Really good to see you again. Thanks so much.
Congratulations on the publication of The Sisterhood, which is out now with Simon & Schuster. Tell us about this book.
I'm really excited about it. So I've written it as a thriller, really faithful to the original 1984 George Orwell. But if you haven't read 1984, you can still read this as a standalone. That's very much the idea. In the original, Winston Smith has a girlfriend, Julia, who's a really silent character. We don't know her surname. We don't know, I say much about her, very little, if anything, about her, what job she does. So I've rewritten some of the story from her perspective. Obviously, 1984 was written in 1948, and the world has moved on a lot for women since then. And I think this freshens her perspective. So I'm very excited about it.
So for anyone listening who isn't familiar with the story of 1984, can you give us a bit of a lowdown?
Yeah, so George Orwell wrote it concerned about dictatorships. Stalin was in government at Russia at the time. He was very worried about people being controlled. And it has this central character, Winston Smith, that does appear in Sisterhood as well. But this is very much a story of friendship and the women involved. But in the original, he seeks this fabled group, the Brotherhood. So the Brotherhood are whispered about. It's known that they want to bring down the oppressive government. And imagine living in North Korea, for example. Perhaps there are people that want to change things. And very much in George Orwell's 1984, that wonderful classic, it's about his that character, Winston Smith, trying to find anyone that can change the situation, as it were. So this is where this story is also about. It's about what other people are doing at the time, also looking for the same as Winston Smith looked for, which is change, and not to live in a society that is oppressive and cruel and controlling. So, yeah.
So I know that you used to be an English teacher and taught 1984 for years. Do you kind of remember the moment when you thought, oh my gosh, I want to rewrite this in my words?
Definitely. So I still am an English teacher, and I love George Orwell. We teach Animal Farm. There's some little Animal Farm references in there. If you have read it, you might recognise those. Otherwise, I'll just pass you by and that's fine as well. Yeah, definitely. It was COVID lockdown, we were still in schools, a lot of people were working from home, and then the schools had opened up again. And I, every year I talk to like year nine students about, I don't know, about the way that they're monitored in a way that we didn't grow up monitored like that. I didn't, you know, they've got their phones, they've got Alexa and Siri, and their parents can track them on their phone. And there's lots of CCTV, and we pay for stuff mostly now about cash, so you know, it's all traceable, isn't it? They're not worried about it. I'm not saying they should be worried about it. I just wonder if George Orwell would be worried about it. And I think that when lockdown happened, and I remember sort of two things really. One, that I noticed that Julia is spoken to really badly by Winston Smith. So of course the world's moved on. This is post Me Too, and you know, the way that he wrote that then was maybe acceptable for men to talk to women like that. It certainly wouldn't be now, not in what we would deem a loving relationship. And I remember thinking, gosh, this Julia, she's putting up with a lot. Why is she putting up with a lot? And it was then that gave me the idea that maybe there was something that Winston Smith didn't know about her.
Can you read us some, please, Kate?
Yeah, sure. So this extract is right near the beginning of the book, and we see one of the sisterhood being arrested by the Thought Police. They're also known as Thinkpole, and they're this awful sort of secret police that turned up. They turn up in a helicopter, and the scene is set during a public lottery. So they're outside, and that's how the sisterhood meet up. They're not allowed to have friendships, so they have to meet in big crowds to have their conversations, and that's how they move their organization, their tiny little organization of six women forward. And the poll have landed, and it looks like an arrest, so they're very frightened. Before I can move, the think poll rush at us. It seems to be me they are staring at. Fear means my next thought isn't fully formed, but is something pathetically, shamefully selfish, like me, it's me. But then they run past us. I run to see Ruby, who is now 50 meters from me. She's backing up and she can see it's her. Now, all I can think now is her, it's her. Over the oppressive noise of the brass band music and the cheering crowd, I can still hear Leona's gasp of horror. She's already started to sprint towards her sister and the men in black uniforms. I see how this will end for her. She will try to save her sister from the armed Thought Police and will fail. She too will be arrested. I know Ruby's thoughts will be of Leona's safety. I will do what Ruby did for her. I move suddenly, cutting in front of Leona's path. She's quick and strong and her momentum is already great. So when we collide, the impact knocks the air from her. I hear the expulsion of shock and grief. So sorry, Leona, so sorry. I put my arm round her and use the force of the collision to pivot her around into Cecily and Prisha. They collect her from me almost as if it was a practiced, elegant dance. They press against her, holding her, saving her. I turn back to the arrest. The think pole are on her now. She is in the centre of the scrum. She stands no chance. I can't see her face, but through the gaps in their black shod legs, I can see her blue trousers. They buckle, and with that comes the irrational idea. It must be me who saves Ruby. It's not a real thought. Save her with what? But the feeling is a powerful emotion. I can no more save her than Leona can, but instinct propels me to turn towards her, and I start to move. But in the seconds of that movement, I feel a sharp shove and then pain in my leg, and I'm pushed to the ground. My head hits the pavement, and for a few blissful seconds, I don't think about anything other than the white pain in my head and the nothingness that brings. I breathe through the grey. For a moment, there is only peace. Then it's Eleanor standing above me, and she's apologising formally, her hands extended to help me up. And she says something stupid, something I don't understand until later, something like, oh, silly me, this silly wheeled thing. So sorry, I didn't see you there. I was played at my own game. Cecily reaches down too, even though no arm round Leona, and she and Eleanor both help me to stand. Leona's eyes are shut and her body is limp like someone cut a circuit. The final number is called and the noise of the explosions is loud. Around the square, there are devices filled with glitter that pump into the air. I watch the gold and silver pieces fire into the sky. The pieces turn, catching the sunlight. A moment of glitz against the grey. Music plays. Everyone is cheering. Eleanor is half holding, half restraining Leona. But the fight has gone out of her now, as it has for me, because now there is only the helicopter and its door is sliding shut. The blades are speeding up and the noise of the engine has started again. Someone is screaming and for a moment I think it's me. Prisha appears in the crowd, her face slack with processing emotion. But it's not her screaming. Then I realise it's somebody in the crowd and he's pushing to the stage. He takes the microphone and announces, I've won! We've lost. The absurdity of the timing, him winning just as Ruby is taken, is an insult. It's a fix. The chances of the winner being in this very crowd, is it just a stunt to distract the crowd? Do they know about us? Or has Ruby been betrayed by her new contact? Or is it none of these things? As the helicopter takes off, I want to run to it and beat the doors and warn Ruby what she already knows, that they are taking her to her death. Dear Ruby, sweet, steadfast, try-hard Ruby is gone. And all Eleanor, Prisha, Cecily and Leona have is a crowd of cheering people too blind to see the reality of their world.
Thank you so much, Kate. It's such a gripping and exciting book. I highly, highly recommend it. But one thing I'd really love to know is what issues you came up against with modernising a classic which is so widely read and so widely loved.
Exactly. I think Definitely coming from a place of respect, and so I've kept the same themes and the motifs as the original text. Having to know it really well, I think, you know, you've got to be on it, you've got to know it really well, and to know the backstory. So I've quite widely read Orwell, so not just taking the stuff at face value, though people could read it like that if they wanted to, just as a straight thriller, but having that depth of ideas that obviously George Orwell had. So definitely being respectful to the text. And very much, I wouldn't have done it, even though I had the idea, if there wasn't something new to say. So I think that was sort of key for me, really. It was kind of, if you're just going to, I don't know, put another viewpoint on it, even a female perspective, that's so important. But if that was all it was, then I'm not sure I would have done it. I'm sure somebody else would have done it, but I'm not sure I would have done it. But I think after lockdown and teaching in lockdown and the realities of that, I suppose would Orwell still want us to beat the drum? Would he, if he was here, still want to have people to be having those conversations about good government, about control, about what freedom we have as individuals, about how people are treated with respect and love in society? Would he still have something to say? And I don't know, but I think we can all look in the news and we can all see discussions about governments and laws and stuff like that around the world, perhaps. And I think perhaps he still would want those conversations to happen. So definitely done from a place of respect, definitely having a female perspective. Obviously, he was a teacher himself. I'm a teacher. So definitely coming from that idea that actually he didn't really explore the female character. So that's the bit I've done, but very much kind of would Orwell still want us to beat the drum? Is this something that he would still want us to be talking about?
Absolutely. And what's the reaction been like to the book so far? I know it's only just come out, but it's garnered some
reviews. Yeah, great. Yeah, I'm absolutely really pleased. And there is this beautiful indie version, which the Independents have. Don't know if you can see that. How good is that? Sprayed edges with the eye on it. Yeah. That is a lovely thing, isn't it? So really good gift. I mean, that's signed, that's in the Independents. I love the fact that Simon and Schuster have done that for the Independents. So yeah, I mean, it's got people talking, which I think is the idea. I think Orwell, you know, really struggled with people sort of saying, well, this couldn't be done, or, you know, it's not possible, having their own take on it. So yeah, great to enter the fray. But yeah, the reviews are great.
So you sold this book on a 2-book deal. What is next? Are we going to be writing in a similar vein, or have you got a completely different idea?
Yeah, so I always loved thrillers. So my first two, to keep you safe, and what I did were psychological thrillers under the name of Kate Bradley. And I think I'm always going to be a thriller girl. I like to read fiction that is compulsive, that turns the pages, that shows, maybe shines a light on an issue in the world. So I've covered some big issues. If you like sort of big issues with your fiction, then that I say these sort of thrillers, I hope to sort of do that. I love a book group, you know, I've been in a book group for years, so I love those sort of like talking points. So I still want to do that, and I've got a great idea for a near dystopian, so sort of set around now, with a really sort of like great original idea. Because I mean, as much as I've loved venturing into another writer's world, it's much easier to do your own. So I'm writing that at the moment, and that's, I think, maybe not due out till 2025 actually, because this is going to come out in the paperback later in the year, and then that's 2025.
So you've got a nice bit of time to work on that.
Yes. So, I'm back in my world.
Absolutely. So you're a writer in Brighton, Kate. I would love to know a little bit about like how you feel as being a writer in Brighton. Do you write out in cafes? Are you part of writing groups? Are you friends with other Brighton writers? Are you kind of part of the community here?
Yeah, absolutely. I love writing in coffee shops. It's my absolute favourite, I have to say. Quite hard to resist all the nice. We've got such good bakeries, haven't they? They've just got better and better and better, I have to say. Yeah, I love writing in Brighton. Know lots of writers. And readers as well, because we're all readers as well, right? So love that. Love meeting other readers and writers and talking fiction. I've been in a book group. Gosh, I think it lasted 10 years. And then I'm looking for another one because it all sort of finished around COVID, you see. So these, it's really good to sort of always talk about book stuff with other writers. Of course, I work locally in a department with other English teachers. We like talking about books, obviously. So.
So, Kate, how can people find and follow you and grab a copy, especially a gorgeous indie version copy of The Sisterhood?
Yeah, City Books, I think, have got some in Hove. Waterstones, it's in Waterstones on the second floor in Brighton. So you have to go upstairs, and then I think they've put it with the Dystopia, but they might have moved it since I was last in. I'm on Twitter. I pretty much always follow back. I'm Kate Bradley. At Kate _ Bradley.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, really good. Really enjoyed it. Always nice to see you.
I am joined by Mark Slater and Kathy Hayward, who are running the Creative Writing Programme in Brighton and are here to tell us more about it. Welcome both to the Brighton Book Club.
Oh, thanks, Anna.
Thanks, Anna. Nice to be here.
Mark, can you tell us about the Creative Writing Programme and how long it's been running in Brighton?
Well, it's been running in Brighton for about 14 years now. It used to be, I set it up at the University of Sussex, but I left the University of Sussex when top-up fees came in because it became too expensive for adults to apply for the courses at the university, and I realised I could offer the same course at a much cheaper price elsewhere. So Brighton seemed to be the obvious place.
And can you tell us a bit about the courses that you run? Because there's a few from poetry, fiction, non-fiction.
Yes. So when I was at Sussex University, I spent a lot of time doing literature and philosophy and then digging myself out from underneath all the theory as a writer. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to put a program together for writers, specifically for writers, which really focused on the creative process. As opposed to applying critical and conceptual frameworks to literature, which tends to be what happens at university courses. So I spent a lot of time when I was doing my doctorate at Sussex researching and planning and developing what I thought was the right way to teach creative writing.
And what makes this different from a master's, for example?
Okay, so I've taught on MAs at universities. If you're at a university doing an MA, you will be under the provision of the exam board of the university. Now, universities like to be seen as academic institutions. So what they do is they insist that about 50% of what is taught on an MA is academic. So you will be studying theory, you will be studying historical periods of literature. All can be interesting, you know, if you're of that kind of bent and you're interested in how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. But if you actually want to write stories, then it's not necessarily the right way to go about doing it. I've worked with lots of really good writers on MAs who are tearing their hair out because they have to write essays on post-structuralism, and it really has no relevance to what they are doing and what they are trying to achieve as artists.
So when can people apply for your next lot of courses, and what do you have on offer, and who is teaching them?
Okay, so we have a great group of writer tutors, people who I've worked with for years and years in Brighton, many people who, when I left the University of Sussex, came over to work with us from the Open University. They were teaching on the Open University, Brighton-based writers, all very experienced tutors, and I was working with them at Sussex, and we moved everything across when we moved into Brighton. The courses that we offer are two-year part-time programs in creative writing and creative nonfiction. They're the main courses that we teach. And these courses will take you from absolute zero to the point where you have a book or a novel that is solid, workable, and can be finished. And we have a model of learning that we use on the program, which is called a helical model. And the idea is you start with very, very simple elements of the writing process, and you build and build and build and build and build, and you keep coming around, back round on yourself as you get higher and higher and higher, and you learn more and more about the complexity of the process. So it's a building process. It's a building model that we put into place, very, very much focused on the creative process, as I said, and also on the fact that when you sit down with a book, you don't just sit down with your brain, you sit down with your whole body. So reading is a whole body experience. It's a physical, emotional, as well as an intellectual experience. And that tends to be forgotten at universities for some reason.
So I know that you guys have a kind of online and offline teaching model, and when you're teaching in person, you're using the gorgeous Kemptown Bookshop Cafe as your venue. So now feels like a good time to bring Kathy in, who's actually going to be taking over the creative writing program next year. Kathy, how's it been having these groups meet in your bookshop?
Oh, I don't know. It's just fabulous because when I took over the bookshop last May, I really wanted to create a space that writers would come and write in as well as read and meet and talk to one another. And to see a group of writers up there on Monday and Tuesday mornings and in the evenings doing exactly that is just so joyous. It's such a great space, I think, as a writer to write and to learn.
And you are an alumni of this program, is that right?
I am, which is how I met Mark in the first place and got involved. So I did the course from 2015 to 17. And as Mark said, I started off as I trained as a journalist. So I was writing, but not creatively. I out of the over the course of the 2 years, I developed a story which eventually became my debut novel. So what Mark was saying about taking a sort of a novice writer to someone who has a novel, I got it published in 2021.
And what Brighton writers did you work with on your project?
So I worked with one of the tutors actually from the course, who is Rosie Chard, who was the second tutor I had. And she then helped me develop the story and also helped me approach agents and gave me some tips. And she was really instrumental in that process.
So for anyone listening, Kathy, that thinks that they would be really interested in joining the creative writing program, what advice would you give them? What would you say to them?
Well, we run taster days in July and September, where you can come along for a couple of hours, meet some of the tutors, try out what sort of a little snippet of the course and see if it's for you. So I suggest coming along to one of those, signing up to that, see what you think, and then hopefully join the course in October when we start.
Wonderful. And how can people find out more?
So we have a website, creativewritingprogramme.org.uk, and we're also on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram.
And one more question while I've got you here. What have you got coming up at the bookshop over the summer that we should get into our diaries?
We have a literary event every Thursday, and it's always free and it's open to everyone and anyone. We always put on a bit of free wine, so it's a really lovely way, if you're at a loose end on a Thursday evening at 7 o'clock, come along to the bookshop. All the events are on Eventbrite. We do ask that people sign up for a free ticket so we know who's coming. But we've got, over this summer, we've got everyone from very end of April, a group of fantastic queer poets are doing a poetry reading. We've got book launches, local author Jane Crittenden launching her new book, Worlds Apart. We've got Amy Lavelle, who's a Brighton-based author, launching her second book. The brilliant Sadia Azmet and her memoir, Sex Bomb. Sadia is a really well-known comedian, but is also a hijab-wearing Muslim woman. And she talks a lot about sex, and her memoir is amazing. And yeah, a great load of events through the summer. So yeah, do pop by.
Well, thank you very much, Mark, and thank you very much, Kathy. And I hope that if you've heard this, you've been thinking about maybe doing some more writing, that you feel inspired.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks very much, Hannah.
Jane Crittenden's debut novel is an emotional one that asks, can first love survive 18 years, 11,000 miles, and a lifetime of misunderstandings? 18 years ago, teenage Amy fled England, pregnant and heartbroken, to start over in New Zealand with her parents. Now Chris, the love she left behind, has walked into her beloved cafe by the beach and thrown her life into turmoil. As far as Amy's concerned, Chris chose to ignore the child she was carrying when they last met. She brought up their daughter alone and created a happy home for them both on the other side of the world. But with Chris suddenly back in her life, she can no longer ignore the past and begins to wonder what really happened all those years ago. Old secrets and new revelations cast Amy's world into doubt. What if this is her last chance at something truly meaningful? Can there really be a happy ending for everyone? Welcome to the Brighton Book Club, Jane, and congratulations.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can you tell us where the idea for Worlds Apart came from?
So my husband and I lived in New Zealand for a few years back in 2003. And it's such a beautiful place to live. The landscape's wonderful, scenery, the lifestyle. And when I first set out to try and write a book, that was the first thing that I thought I wanted to include was something about New Zealand. The other thing is, I'd heard over the years stories about people having sort of coincidences of bumping into people in random places while they were traveling or on holiday. That had happened to my husband a few times. And so I sort of like that idea that you could be a long way from home, but someone you know could just suddenly walk back into your life. And I suppose the third idea was this sort of thinking that there's this big, huge distance between people, and could they keep a friendship going, keep a relationship going, and sort of looking at that idea.
So what is your writing process? Because you've got a dual narrative, you've got two voices in this. Did you write kind of consecutively, or did you write their parts separately?
Yeah, now that, well, this story evolved over sort of 6-7 years of writing. So there was no planned process. I think I felt like I didn't want to tell the story from Amy's point of view in the past. I wanted to try and look at it from another angle. And I guess that's how that side of the story began. And then as I carried on over the years, I used to do chunks of the present in Amy's voice and chunks of the past in her friend Olivia's voice. And then as I came closer to bringing it together, I didn't want to be sort of too restricted by alternative chapters. I kind of went with my gut feeling about when to sort of move from one timeline to another. And it's sort of, yeah, felt, I guess I knew the story so well after all those years, it felt quite instinctive.
And can you read us some, please?
Yes, of course. So this is at the beginning, chapter one, and it's in Amy's voice. He's here. I don't feel a rush of excitement, nor a surge of blissful happiness. No swell of pleasure, not even a tiny sigh of relief. Nothing good registers in my brain or my body to encourage me to connect with this man. Instead, sharpness twists my chest and I think, why now? Only minutes before, Shannon and I had been belting out a song that was playing on the radio in my empty cafe. She'd held the broom handle like a microphone and I twirled around her in my scarlet dress, a purchase she convinced me to make a few weeks before. I was still humming as we carried on clearing away the aftermath of the party. And when I stuck my head inside the glass display counter to sweep up the cake crumbs, he said my name. I straightened up, but not because his voice set my heart aflutter or because I noticed his English accent, but simply because somebody, some stranger, called my name. And like with all the customers who had come into my cafe that day to join our celebrations, I said, hello. Now I properly see the man who stands in front of me, and the second twist of my chest is so painful, it obliterates a smile I had ready for this new customer. Amy, he repeats. Amy Curtis, it is you, isn't it? He looks incredulous. Energy sparks his voice, and instinctively I step back, the high heel of a shoe I'm not used to wearing, grinding into Shannon's foot. She mutters a swear word and I shift slightly, letting my gaze stray away from him. Behind, the tables parade the post-party carnage and tangles and pinks of pink balloons sag and nod in the sea breeze that drifts through the open door. The radio's still playing, but I can't hear the music anymore. Why now? It already seems peculiar that just this morning, I stood in this very spot, staring at the vacant tables and the glass display crammed with scones, sponges and cupcakes, voicing my doubts to Shannon that we sell it all. Then I'd unlocked the doors and the first group of customers trailed in. Then the second, the third, and they kept coming, pouring in and jamming themselves onto the terrace outside. There were so many people that we got out just in case fold-out chairs, and customers balanced cake and tea on their laps, spilling onto the beach with picnic blankets. Shannon and I had spun from customer to customer, smiling and laughing. And then, as with all great parties, it was suddenly over. And here he is. My eyes can't connect with his. They butterfly over him and land on the remains of a three-layer anniversary cake sitting on a table to his left. I baked a fruit cake for the bottom, carrot cake for the middle, and then Victoria's sponge, finishing the tiers with a coating of chocolate fudge. The 15 years I carefully iced to mark, an intelligible, sticky scrawl, disappearing as fast as the years since I took over the cafe from Sharon's in-laws, when, don't. I forced myself to look at him. I recognised the tilt in the corners of his mouth. Not smiling exactly, just amused. Then I lock onto his eyes, hazel, just like, don't. It is you. He grins and holds his arms wide as if he expects me to run round from behind the counter and jump into his embrace. I can't believe I found you. Found me? He waves a folded newspaper and I catch a glimpse of my smiling face. I saw the article. I couldn't believe your cafe was just a few miles down the road from me. Down the road? Shan is still clutching the broom handle and suddenly springs back into life. See, Amy, I told you the whole of Auckland would know who you are now. How does it feel to be a celebrity? She squeezes my arm, tighter than is normal or natural, and laughs. The throaty sound usually makes me smile. It's shameless and loud with a hint of something naughty that always makes people glance in her direction as though they might witness something salacious. If anyone's a celebrity around here, it's Shannon, not me. I glance at the identical newspaper article in a frame propped up by the till. Shannon had presented it to me just before the party ended. She'd let out a high-pitched wolf whistle to catch everyone's attention and gave an embarrassing speech about my achievements, which sounded like they belonged to someone else. In the photo, I'm wearing the same scarlet dress as I do now. I'm standing in the doorway of my cafe, holding a tray of red velvet cupcakes iced in creamy vanilla, my mouth stretched into a broad grin. Beneath the picture, five gold stars ring out. The critic described me as a Brit abroad with a genuine nostalgia for home, though in truth I've lived here for half my life. Auckland's best baker, Chris says, pointing the newspaper at me like a weapon. I knew you'd smash it one day, Ames. Ames, I flinch. The memory tears open the scar of all that's gone on before.
Oh, round of applause. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
I absolutely love this book. And one thing that I really, really enjoyed about it was the kind of dual timeline with the voice of teenagers, because it's actually something that I haven't read much in commercial fiction. So Olivia's narrative is kind of in the past when they're kind of 16, 17, doing their A-levels. How did you kind of get yourself back in time to write those voices?
I suppose I just drew on my own past. To some extent. I think what I've found over the years of writing is when you get to know your characters, it's like you slot into their body somehow. I imagine, I don't act, I've never acted, but I imagine that's what actors must do and feel like. So I sort of find myself, once I know them well, I kind of feel like I am them speaking and... So, yeah, but I did draw on my own sort of experiences as a teenager, for sure.
And I'd love to know about what your experience of being published has been like after so many years of writing. Has anything really surprised you?
Well, I mean, I had no expectations. I didn't really know what to expect. I think with Amazon publishing, they're a very organised, quite a slick machine, and I like that. That was a nice surprise because I know where I'm at. I know they give you a production schedule. The editing process is very rigorous. I think I had four editors look at my work. So structural edits, copy edits, proofreading, cold read. So that's brilliant because I know that the book's in the best shape it can be.
Absolutely. So you are a writer in Brighton, and I know that you're an alumni of the Creative Writing Programme, who we spoke to earlier on in today's show. Can you talk a bit about your experience being a writer in Brighton?
I mean, the Creative Writing Programme is fantastic. It was such a good start for me. I went in, I'm a journalist as my day job, so I do write, but I wasn't sure if I was capable of writing a novel. I just wanted to give it a go, and that was why it took so long, because it was a hobby for many years. And the Creative Writing Programme was great at guiding me through that process, and this is how came to this book came to be. But as well as that, we also have the West Hill Writers. Thank you, Anna, which is fantastic as well. I really have enjoyed going to West Hill Writers, and what I love about it is it's a community that just keeps going. You can dip in and out, and I love that. I love that. Another writing group is the Hove Writers. They meet on a Monday evening, and that's run by author Joe Furness. That's also nice place to sort of gather. It's quite casual. Again, you can pop in as you wish. There's writing exercises and someone come and does a talk once a month, and you get a chance to share your work and be critiqued, and that's a really important process of writing a book. So through those three groups, I've met many writers, some amazing experienced people like you, Anna. I just think we're really lucky. I think because we live in a city that's not too big, and it's not a town that's too small, it's easy to find people and make connections. I think we're lucky here.
So you sold Worlds Apart on a two-book deal, which means that I'm sure you are squirreling away behind the scenes working on the next project. What is the second book like? Do you have the dreaded book syndrome?
Yes, I am. This is the worst time to ask me. My deadline is the 1st of May. So I'm right up against it at the moment. The second book, I really wanted to stick with the idea of a destination. So it's set in London and Barcelona, the second book. Also a romance, and also a dual timeline. I'm busy getting that finished to send to my editor at Amazon, and then I'll be going through the editing process again.
And what advice do you have, Jane, for anyone writing commercial fiction?
I think for contemporary romance, I for a long time didn't believe in myself enough with it, and I now do. So I think I'd say to people, believe in what you're doing. Make sure lots of people read your stories before it goes out. That's really important. So those are important things. But also, if you are into writing contemporary romance, books like Romancing the Beats by Gwen Hayes has been really useful for me. It sort of looks at the narrative arc and plotting from a romance perspective, and it makes sure that it follows what your reader is expecting to a point to happen, not the actual story, but the process of romance blooming and blossoming and then falling apart and coming back together. And another book I draw upon is The Emotion Thesaurus, and that book, that's by Angela Ackerman and Becca Pugliese. That book's quite good for just making everything sound fresh, because that's the one thing about romance, is it isn't easy. I think people might think it's easy, but it isn't easy. You've got to be authentic, you've got to keep being original. So using things like The Emotion Thesaurus and Romance of the Beats just helps keep everything fresh.
And who are your biggest influences in your writing?
So Leah Lewis writes good romance books. I like her books. Leanne Moriarty, of course. What I like about hers is the structure of her stories. I like the way she starts off with that big sort of blast of something happens and then gradually unfolds, and we learn to find out why that event happened. That is very much a style that I emulate, I think, a little bit. And Emily Henry, at the moment, I am completely in awe of. Mm-hmm. I'm reading The Beach Read, and her way of dealing with romance is fantastic. I love it.
Absolutely. I read The Book Lovers on holiday last summer, and I just was completely entrapped by it. It was gorgeous. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Jane. How can we find and follow you and get our hands on a copy of Worlds Apart?
Worlds Apart is on Amazon, as I am being published by Amazon Publishing. And I'm mainly on Instagram, which is at Jane Crittenden. I dip in and out of Twitter, and there I am, Crittenden_Jane.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our next book club book is Amita Murray's Unladylike Lessons in Love. This is a fast-paced and feisty Regency fiction with a dazzling, daring heroine who breaks the mould. As the daughter of an English earl and his Indian mistress, impulsive Leela Marley has already broken the rules of society into tiny pieces. When a face she never thought she would see again appears and begs for help, Leela must court notoriety once more and pit her wits against the annoyingly handsome aristocrat Ivor Tristan. But does she risk opening her heart to the one person who can break it? I love romantic fiction and I love contemporary romance, and I'm really looking forward to reading Amita's new book. Don't normally read things set in the Regency era, so I'm really excited to see what she does with it, and we will be talking to her on next month's show. Let us know what romantic fiction you love over on Instagram. I'd love to curate a list of everyone's favourite romantic summer reads. Thank you for listening. As I'm sure you know, May in Brighton is Fringe Month, and I thought I'd do a shout out for some of the shows that we are planning to go to this year. We are going to see A Little Killing Hurts No One, Cheat, Aaron Twitchen, No Shade, okay, A Little Shade, Filthy Fridays, Brighton Bells, Sunsets, Big Fat Gay, Annabelle Edmonds, Gremlin, Big Cuck, Little Cuck, Call Me Daddy, the musical, Marmalade, Circus Abyssinia, and Mythos Ragnarok. I'm really excited and also quite exhausted just thinking about it, and I cannot wait to go and see their new venue, Caravansary. If you have an idea for the show, you can email us at btnbookclub@gmail.com, and you can follow us on Instagram at Brighton Book Club. All the books spoken about on today's show are listed in the podcast show notes and over on Instagram. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next month.